Well, good morning. I think we'll go ahead and get started. For those of you who have been in this room at this time the prior 2 days, you were blessed by listening to Tim walk through the background, the history of the world that Ruth and Boaz live in. We talked a lot about the laws and the more you read commentaries, the more you find out. We know some things about how those laws were supposed to function, but we don't know as much about how they actually played out in the life of ordinary people. And yet Ruth seems to be a story that hinges on some understanding of what's at stake because of those laws. When it came to what do you do in a world where if you're a woman and you're not in some way attached to a man who can protect and provide and care for you, that you are extremely vulnerable, that there's really no future for you. And so in that kind of world, it would make sense that there were very complex laws and nuances of those laws of who is responsible in that kind of world and taking care of people like Naomi and like Ruth. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I do think a challenge today, we're supposed to be kind of taking what we've heard in the last 2 days about all of those things and what's going on in Ruth and trying to think through, okay, if I were going to preach Ruth, what are the things I'm going to focus on? What are the things that I want the congregation to journey through together as they open their hearts up to this story? And one of the things I've found is it's a really quick and easy way to bore your audience in a sermon if you start getting into ancient legal clauses and nuances and applications, right? And so the difficulty there is you've got to figure out, okay, how do we help people understand what's at stake because of the laws without getting into the point where people aren't listening anymore because they can't follow what we're talking about? Now, Tim did a really good job the last 2 days, I think, of introducing those laws without getting to the point of us saying, okay, well, here's all the different examples that we can find in Scripture and outside of Scripture of how all that worked, and then that's it. Every day, the last 2 days, Tim has moved beyond that to, okay, so what? Right? And that's what all preaching has to do as well. But here's basically how I would say, This is one possibility of how we might think about preaching through Ruth or being someone who teaches a class through Ruth. And that's kind of what we're going to be focusing on together. And I hope that you're in the right room because that's how we're going to spend the next few minutes together. The first thing that I would do with a story like Ruth is spend a class period or an entire sermon simply telling the story from beginning to end. Now, on one hand, you may feel like, well, you're giving away everything. But what I have found is it's hard to dig deeper into a story that you don't have working knowledge of. And if you break a story up, especially a story that's as well written and as relatively short as Ruth, you can end up making small sections of that story mean things that if you'd read the whole story, you'd realize, well, you know, actually, when Ruth says those beautiful promises, she's not at a wedding, and she's not saying it to her husband. She's saying it to her mother-in-law, and that matters, that she's saying these words to somebody she's not marrying. And it matters that we've read those words, and they seem so convicting and so self-sacrificial, we've decided the only person I would ever say that to is someone I would marry. Right? So I think it's important, especially in today's church, I feel more and more that we might know snippets of Scripture and we might know how someone else has applied a story from Scripture, but most people in most congregations don't have a working knowledge of stories that we assume they do. And that's especially true with Ruth, because what most people know about Ruth, if you haven't been at the Bible lectures, you know more now. But usually, if you know, you haven't been at a lecture, you haven't been in a class, what you basically know is Ruth and Boaz get married. And it's a love story and it's great. And that's in Ruth, but there's certainly other things going on. And so I would tell the story in its entirety as well as I possibly could. I would include as many of the details as I felt like I needed to help people understand the overarching plot line. And I wouldn't avoid troublesome things like the hero of the story happens to be a woman who's an immigrant. And that everyone in the story, especially Boaz, has to decide how he's going to treat somebody who's not from there. Now, I think you can make a mistake given, say, our current political national conversations about immigrant policy and immigration, all that kind of stuff. I think you have to be careful, but I think you've got to say something because it's in the story. And so I'm not saying you want to magnify it to an outsized degree where it's all you're talking about, but I think it would be a disservice to people to pretend that's not a big part of what's happening here. How do God's people respond to people who aren't from here who need help? And that's a conversation that's going on throughout the Old and New Testaments of, okay, we've got to strike this balance of holding on to a core identity of who we are as God's people and knowing that other people and other cultures can shape our imaginations in ways that lead us farther from being the kinds of people that we were trying to be. And yet also understanding that one of the most important things about who we're supposed to be is that we're good to people who don't have a home and don't have a place to belong, and we find a place for them. This story is made possible because God's people are wrestling with how to be faithful in times of famine, in times of crisis and tragedy. How do they treat people who come to them, who end up on their doorstep? So I think you tell the sweep, the whole story, and you help people get a working knowledge of the fact that, you know, Ruth really is from another place, that the reason that she comes into the story is because of famine, and she's so they're treated well, right? Basically, Naomi and Elimelech, they find another home because they need to be there to survive, and they settle down. And their sons get married, and then their sons pass away. Elimelech, I mean, it's the worst case scenario you could imagine. If you've ever lost anybody who's as close to you as a spouse or a child, try to get your head wrapped around losing everybody. And they've got to figure out what to do, because three women at the beginning of the story, in a world like that, where if, again, they're not attached relationally to a man who can protect and provide for them, either a father or a husband, they're not going to make it. What do? Well, they go back. Naomi tries to go back home, and she brings Ruth. Now, Ruth doesn't have to go with her. Ruth legally doesn't have to go with her. Right? Naomi releases her and says, look, we've all got to look out for ourselves here. And three women are harder to take care of than one. So let's just split up. You guys go back to your father's homes, and I'll try to hope that I can find some man in my hometown that's going to take care of me and watch out for me. And so when Orpah says, okay, I'll listen to you and I'll go back, she's doing the normal, rational thing. In fact, in some ways, she may be trying to alleviate some of Naomi's stress of trying to provide for her and take care of her. And I think it's easy for us to kind of treat Orpah, because she's barely in the story, like her decision is just this, you know, heartless, selfish decision. But I think at some level, it's the normal, everyday decision somebody would make in that situation, and it would be completely understandable. It's Ruth that's acting crazy, right? It's Ruth that's doing something that doesn't make sense. And in fact, in the moment, had to be a mixture for Naomi of this relief that she wasn't going to be alone, but now there's two mouths to feed, right? And so it's still, the story is not out of the woods yet. So they go back to Bethlehem, and there are laws, right, for God's people, where you don't glean all the way to the edges of the fields for people who are in need and hungry. And so there's space for them that's already provided. And Ruth can't just say pretty words to Naomi. She can't just say, I'll go with you anywhere we go, and I'll be with you, and your people will be my people, and your God will be my God, and I'll be buried where you're buried. And she's got to actually do what she's promised to do. And it's nothing that I think we would feel like is the most exciting task in the world. She's going to roll her sleeves up, and she's going to pick leftover grain so they don't starve. And Boaz sees this happening, and something goes on in his heart when he sees somebody who's willing to work that hard for another person, to take care of another person that they don't have to take care of. But they promised, she's promised to take care of Naomi, so she's going to no matter what. And Boaz responds to her in ways that he doesn't have to. Right? And so we've got two people at the center of the story who are captivating to us in our imaginations because they make a choice nobody's forcing them to make that's extremely costly, and they do it because it's who they are. And there's a part of anybody who listens to this story that wants to ask the question, is that who I am? Is that who I could be? And so by the time you get to the end of the story, it almost feels like it started out so difficult. I mean, there's parts of it that for those of us who've ever read a book like Grapes of Wrath or something, it starts out where there's almost no hope and there's no goodness. And by the end, people are good to each other in the midst of brokenness and in the midst of not knowing how they're going to actually take care of each other, but they're going to try to take care of each other. And then right at the end of the story, there's this baby that's born. Who is a direct gift from God, and it's a possibility that just a few chapters earlier doesn't even seem like it's on the horizon. Right? So you tell the whole sweep of the story, and you tell enough of the details to help people understand, okay, at some level, it is a story about two people who love each other and get married and then have this child, and it's this romance. There's something there. But if we turn the book of Ruth into a romantic comedy that we stumbled on in the Bible, we're missing the deeper truths of what's going on that have nothing to do with romance and nothing to do with people simply doing what they feel like doing. So the first thing I would do is tell that whole sweep. The next thing I would do is deal with the fact that what really is the constant in the story is this question of where is God when our hearts are breaking, when our lives are falling apart. I think Mike mentioned that this feels very much like a female story of Job, and that's exactly right. And Naomi talks like Job talks in the first chapter. She says, you know, my life has fallen apart and God has abandoned me and I'm empty. Now, I think what's important, you know, when we read a narrative like this is, now that's how she feels, and she's telling the truth of how she feels. But it doesn't mean she's right. It doesn't mean that she's telling the whole truth. And in fact, what I think is really important is not rushing past the tragedy and not rushing past the truth of how bad it's hurting, but understanding in the midst of that, that God is at work. And that you have to look to find where God is at work. And in Ruth chapter 1, God is at work in the least expected place, which is in this foreign woman who has no way to actually take care of Naomi. Not really. Suddenly making this unexpected promise to her to be with her. And I want to read that together. And so if you've got a Bible, if you'd open up to Ruth chapter 1, we'll be starting together. If I can get this to work. I've been having trouble with the electronic Bibles lately. I should probably go back to the old. You know these words, right? Let's read the actual quote that we know so well. So you've got Orpah and Ruth, they're weeping, they're trying to figure it out, and Orpah listens to her mother-in-law, Naomi, who says, just go back and have your father take care of you. Have somebody who already knows you take care of you, because you're not just a widow. You're a widow without a child. And, you know, at some level, if we're going to be blunt, in their context, they have no right to hope that someone else is going to take care of them. And Ruth says, where you go, I'll go. Where you stay, I'll stay. I'll make your people my people. I'll make your God my God. I promise to stay with you and take care of you until the day I die. Now, I know from experience at some level that while we have heard these in weddings before, these words, the reason we've heard these words in weddings is there really isn't a more beautiful set of promises in the Bible given from one person to another. There just aren't. These are beautiful words, especially spoken in the midst of uncertainty where they don't know what's going to happen next. Ruth, she won't listen to reason. She knows the facts, but she doesn't stop at just accepting those facts and deciding, well, okay, we just need to do what everybody else would do in this moment. She chooses to love Naomi no matter what has already happened to them or what might happen to them in the future. And she doesn't love Naomi by just being nice to her or having this fond attitude toward her. She loves her by saying that no matter what happens, I'm not going anywhere. I find that we are often tempted in the church community when somebody's life is falling apart. And their first reaction, Naomi's reaction, I think is understandable, which is distancing herself from other people. I think tragedy and pain often have that effect on us, where we withdraw and we try to get away from other people. And I think Naomi even is starting to feel like she's cursed and everybody around her is going to be cursed because of her. So get away from me. I'm not somebody you want in your life. And I find that in church when that happens, too often we actually do what those people ask us to do, which is we kind of just say, okay, if you don't want anybody close to you right now, we'll give you your space. And I'm afraid what tends to happen is the rest of us move on pretty quickly from the tragedy and the brokenness that person is wrestling with. And I think the other response we often give is we tend to try to assign meaning to what they're going through. And that's always a dangerous thing for us to do with somebody else's life and the brokenness that they're experiencing. That when you try to figure out, this is also true in the book of Job, right? When you try to theologize with people about why things are falling apart, you are very likely to either describe God in ways that make it hard for them to lean on God and to trust in God, or you say things that make them feel like they've done something to deserve what they're going through. Ruth doesn't do that. Ruth's words to Naomi are not, well, let me explain to you why this happened, and I'll be praying for you. That's not what she says. She says, I'm here, and I'm not going anywhere. And when people are asking the question, where is God when our hearts are breaking, they don't actually need some sort of answer about where God actually is. They need God to show up through you. They don't need you to explain their suffering. They need you to share it. That's a really hard decision for us to make unless we're forced. It's really difficult to know that somebody is at the beginning of putting their life back together again. And to decide, I'm going to stay with you, not just in this moment, but I'm going to journey with you from this moment on. And I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that I'm going to be here with you. This is the kind of love that God has for Israel. It's the kind of love that God has described having towards his people, and not just his people, but anyone who wants to have a relationship with God. It's chesed, right? It's that loving kindness and loyalty that's chosen. It's never forced. And Ruth models that it's possible. And one of the things that I think becomes important if you're preaching through Ruth is you can't just say to people, okay, be there, be a godly presence in someone's life when they're hurting. You're going to have to help them imagine what that looks like. And to me, I would hope that as teachers or preachers, none of us would struggle to have some experience in our life we could share where somebody made the self-sacrificial decision to stay and to be a faithful presence in someone's life when they're going through something they're not sure they're going to make it through. I think personally of a time in my life where my wife Lauren and I had a very close friend our age die of a brain tumor, and it happened very quickly, and it was hard for anybody to be ready for that, but it was especially hard for his wife Dana to wrestle with what does it mean to be a widow in your 30s with three children. And I mean, I was on the phone with Dana when Kirk died, when he took his last breath. And over the course of the months and now what's becoming the years since he has passed away, is I have watched my wife stay with Dana in her grief in ways that have impacted her life. And I have watched as she, you know, we moved in the middle of that from Dallas to Abilene. I don't know why we moved to Abilene, but that's a longer story, but it's been a good thing for us. But we moved away from her best friend when her best friend needed her most. And there were times that I felt like that was my fault, right, that we had moved away from that situation. But Lauren, I don't even know how many times Lauren has driven from Abilene to Dallas to be with Dana on Kirk's birthday and on Dana's birthday and on hard days when Dana just needs somebody to talk to about something that's going on in her life. And there's a cost that's exacted there. Right? It impacts our family for Lauren to make that decision. And yet it's something that has really changed my understanding of what it really means. If you're going to say to somebody, I'm not going anywhere, I'm going to be here for you, then you better get in the car and drive to Dallas when your friend needs you. And I think you've got to find that story, right, for you. One of the things that's been encouraging to me is right at the beginning, it happens so often, that our church stepped up to help me with the girls. We have two daughters, and they go to school, and they got to be picked up, and all. We had all kinds of people at our church start to step up to help me while Lauren was present for Dana. Right, and so it becomes this ripple effect of people serving and sacrificing and trying to help one another be present when it matters most. It's possible, and it's one of the most important reasons we're in church communities. But I find too often that when people suffer, we tend to distance ourselves from them, and they tend to distance themselves from us. And it takes some courage, and it definitely takes faithfulness to say, no. We don't have to talk about it all the time, and I'm not going to try to explain it. And I just want to be there for you. And it can't just be that we make those kinds of promises to somebody that we would be willing to marry. We've got to make those promises to other people in our lives who need to have that experience. And in that same way, I think we've got to admit that we're all people who have made promises in our lives. And that promises only have real power when they forever dictate how you live from that moment on. I'm guessing every time that you attend a wedding, if you're married, or if you've made significant promises to another person, that when you go to a wedding and you hear those vows spoken, you are brought back to your own commitments that you've made to other people, and you start to ask yourself, okay, how many of those commitments have I actually faithfully kept? How many of those have I walked away from because I just decided they were too hard or they were too difficult? Ruth makes this promise. And the way she keeps it is by picking leftover wheat. And one of the things that is interesting to me at that point is Boaz hears about the fact that Ruth has not only made the promise to take care of Naomi, but she is actually taking care of Naomi. He hears that and he wants to see who this person is. Who makes that kind of promise and keeps it? And one of the things we start to see happening is Ruth's example to everybody around her helps them remember that it actually is possible to live like this, to do these things. And Boaz makes the decision that he wants to be like Ruth. He wants to make extravagant promises, not because anybody's making him, but because it's the person he wants to be. Every time I do a wedding, I'm shocked that they're agreeing to this stuff. I mean, I think it's part of why people dress up and come to attend, to watch two people make insane promises to each other. That if they fully understood what it was going to mean to live those promises out, like if you could actually sit down and explain it, they'd say, yeah, no, I don't think I don't, I'm not sure I'm up to that. Like that's, but you make those promises anyway, because part of being the kind of person that God has created us to be is be people who say, I know that I'm making the promise, not fully understanding. I know that I'm saying I'm going to be with you no matter what the future holds, and I don't know what the future holds. I care about you enough to make this crazy promise anyway. And then I'm going to do my very best to keep it in any way that I can. So Boaz comes up to her, and he starts speaking to her. And it's interesting because it's like they're trying to have a normal conversation, but he immediately starts speaking words of blessing over her. He starts to pray over her. And says, may God shelter you in the shadow of his wing. This beautiful image of protection and care for a woman who desperately needs protection and care. And then he follows those words up with saying, I want to make sure you don't have to just take the leftover grain on the far edges of the fields. You can follow behind my workers right close, and you can have water, and I've told the men not to touch you. I'm trying to protect you. And it's interesting to me that I think if we could admit that too often we walk away from promises we've made because they get too complicated or they get too difficult to keep, that we start to think that's how everybody is and that's the way the world has to be, and that if we as church people would start to make promises and keep them, no matter what, that instead of condemning other people who struggle to keep their promises, at least we would remind them what's possible. I think that's what's going on with Boaz. I think he surprises himself when he starts talking to her that way. When he starts talking about God watching over her and taking care of her, and then he starts to talk about what he's going to do. I think all of that is just a natural response to somebody who's living the way Ruth is living. For Naomi. She's not just living with Naomi. She's helping Naomi stay alive, and she's doing everything she can to keep her promises. And Boaz wants to be that kind. He doesn't want to just know that kind of person. He wants to be that kind of person. And we want to be those kinds of people. So the question then becomes, and Ruth really wrestles with this, the story of Ruth. How many times have you and I missed the chance to be the answer to our own prayers for other people? So Boaz says, may God shelter you in the shadow of his wing, right? And I'm going to protect you. I'll make sure you have some food. But that's about as far as it goes. But Naomi's been thinking. And it gets to the end of the harvest season, and she says to Ruth, I think it's time for you to have an encounter with Boaz to see if he really is the kind of person that I think that he is. So she sends Ruth, and one of the things that's really difficult in this is a part of the story that reminds you of just how much this is a man's world, and they're playing by rules that reduce women to objects of sexual desire, and so she says to her, you know, wash up put on some perfume and put your best dress on and go to him. And Ruth has a very simple response to that. She just says, I'll do whatever you say. But what's going on here, and I think we've got this is difficult in church to talk about this, especially like when I preach, we've got everyone from first graders up in the room. But I think you've got to find a way to talk about that this midnight meeting is just as awkward as you think it is. That she is offering herself to Boaz. Now, I want to believe Ruth knows Boaz well enough to not be afraid of what he might do to her. That she's more afraid of what he won't do for them. But she's still offering herself to him. She goes there. And sometimes in Hebrew, feet is a euphemism for genitals. And so it says when she uncovers his feet, it could mean that she's trying to uncover his real feet to make him cold enough to wake him up. But it could also mean that she's directly propositioning him because she's that desperate and Naomi's that desperate for some kind of other future. And Boaz refuses to see her that way. He refuses to treat her that way. And he understands what's going on. And he instead wants to protect her honor because she's a woman of honor. It's who she is. He's a man of honor. It's who he is. And so he understands what she's asking. Now, here's what one of the things that I think is really neat about the conversation. I feel like Ruth's simple statement to him shows a knowledge of all these laws that Tim's been talking about for the last couple of days. And anyone who heard the story would know that Ruth's being pretty creative here and that Boaz has all kinds of legal loopholes to get out of it. So she says something to him that basically in one statement she says, will you cover me with the corner of your garment? Will you cover me with the shadow of your wings? It's the same exact phrase that he used when he spoke to her and prayed for her. And then she says, you are my kinsman redeemer. Right? You're the one who legally is supposed to take care of me. But that's not true at all. If there's anybody he should legally take care of, it's Naomi. And it's not normal in that day and age for this marriage proposal to come from the woman, which is what she's doing when she's saying, will you cover me with the shadow of your, under the shadow of your, with the corner of your garment? Will you marry me? And will you take care of Naomi? Now, it's not often that a proposal comes with a discussion of the mother-in-law, right? But that's exactly, I mean, this is the whole offer right here. Are you willing to take me as your wife, and are you willing to do what nobody else has offered to do so far? And we'll find out a little bit later, there's somebody else who should actually be kind of stepping up in their custom of redeeming Naomi's name and her property and all those things. He hasn't done that. So she says to him, will you marry me and will you take care of us? And Boaz has every right to say no. And it's just like Orpah, right? It would be the reasonable thing to say, look, that's a lot to take on. I've already got a lot of land. I've already got a lot of people I have to pay and take care of. This could overextend me. I really care about you, Ruth. I don't know about Naomi. Like, none of that's discussed. He's got to make a decision in his own heart. Is he going to do this or not? Is he going to unforced promise to take care of people in need? And he says yes. Right? Now there's a little legal thing where he's got to go and talk to the guy who's actually the one who's more closely related to Naomi and ask. They have a conversation. The guy says, yeah, I can't do that. There's too much risk. And so Boaz is able to follow through on the promise he made. I think at that point in the story, what we've got to encourage people to think through is it's not enough to know somebody's hurting and in need. Tell them you're going to pray for them, and then sit back and watch what God does in answer to your prayer. That if we're going to actually enter into people's life and speak words over them, speak words to God for them, for God to help bring healing and to take care of them and to give them a different future, the very next thing we do is not sit back and wait and see what God is going to do. We roll up our sleeves and we get to work, and we trust that God will join us in that work, that we're partnering with God and doing what we've asked God to do. For both Ruth and Boaz, they don't just say, "I know it's been hard. I hope it gets better. I'll pray for you." They say, "I'm willing to put my own future at risk to help you have a future." Not only is it difficult for us to keep promises, I think it's difficult for us to partner with God in answering prayers for people who we want to see have a different kind of life, but we know what that's going to take. And we decide, I'll keep praying about it, and I'll keep hoping that God steps in and does something. But it's up to God at this point. I think when we do that, we run the risk of someone we care about, someone who's a friend, falling deeper into despair and believing, like Naomi does at the beginning of the story, that God has actually abandoned them. God is present in Ruth. God is present in what she does. And God is present in Boaz, who's emulating Ruth, who's following her example. And I think if we're not willing to be the people in someone else's story where there's a turning point, that we're there, and it's not all on our shoulders, we are working with God, cooperating with God to do whatever it is that we can to help them put their broken life back together again. That don't you want to be that for somebody else? I mean, I want to be that. It's going to cost so much more than we're typically willing to give, and yet it's who we want to be. We want to be women and men of noble character. We want to be women and men of love that's stronger than the possible cost of what it's going to take to keep our word. Ruth and Boaz model for us that it's not a fairy tale. It's possible. We just have to have the willingness to be people who make that choice. And so that's what I would do with the final week. It takes a story to make a story is actually a quote from Flannery O'Connor, a really great Christian author. And one of the things I would do at the end of a series like this, you know, hopefully throughout, people are asking themselves who they are in the story as they're listening to it. You know, all of us have had times in our lives where we're Naomi, to different degrees. People in your church are going to, some of them will be Naomi while you're preaching through Ruth. They're not going to be capable of lifting somebody else up, and we shouldn't ask them to. Right? I think we need to tell people, it's okay if that's who you are in the story. But I think everybody, even if they are Naomi in the story and their experience, will long to find a way at some point to be like Ruth and to be like Boaz. And so I think you want to kind of end a series like this to work through, okay, are you going to just kind of be engaged and entertained by this story, or are you going to intentionally take it and make it your own? And one of the things I think is so important about the story of Ruth is it's, I don't really want to call it small, but it is a story of ordinary people making extraordinary promises, and they're heroes because of it. But they're personal domestic promises. You know, it's almost like we're overhearing couples talking. And that seems sometimes like those aren't very important moments in our lives. And yet the story of Ruth says those may be the most important moments of your life, is how you speak to one other person with nobody else around when they're about ready to give up hope, when their faith is about to fall apart. You could be the person who speaks to them and then follows up your words with actions so that they know, even though it feels like God may have abandoned them, God is right there through you. I think that one of the things that's important about that is, and you know, you pick the Old Testament, there's some pretty amazing stories of other heroes. You got Abraham and Sarah leaving everything and having to build a nursery when they're way too old for that kind of thing. And that's amazing. And the parting the Red Sea and David and Goliath and all these other things that go on. And the story of Ruth says, look, you don't have to have a miracle child when you should be getting ready to go, you know, move to Florida. You shouldn't be having this miracle child. You shouldn't have to hold out for a moment like that. You don't have to wait until you're able to do something as amazing as parting the Red Sea and saving hundreds of thousands of people from imminent death. You don't have to fight some sort of humongous giant in order to have people remember your name. You just have to make extravagant, crazy promises and keep them because it's who you are. And everybody should be able to pick at least one other person in their life that they could make those kinds of promises to and start to keep them. And I think one of the things that goes on in our lives is we pick the wrong kinds of stories to base our life stories on. And they're usually stories that are about us and our happiness and our fulfillment. And what would happen to our friendships and our marriages and our churches if we were less focused on ourselves and our relationships, and we were trying to figure out how to be Ruth to the Naomis in our lives, how to be Boaz to somebody like Ruth, right? How to figure out how to take care of those who are in the most need. Not because of anything we're going to get out of it, but because we're trying to be people who look like and talk like and act like the God who created us. And so at the end of a series like this, I think it's okay. You know, I try to resist when I do Old Testament material to immediately go to Christ. Because the gospel's there in Ruth. But what's neat about the very end of Ruth is there's a direct connection from this child they have, Obed, which just means servant of the Lord, right? God's servant. Which at some level, isn't this story about a bunch of people who are just being simple servants? He's going to have this great descendant named David, who's going to have an even greater descendant named Jesus. And so it's not just that they're connected on a literary standpoint. I mean, they're genetically connected, right? That there's a direct link from these two people to Jesus. And you could go to a place like, you know, 1 Corinthians 1, where it talks about all the promises of God are yes in Christ. You can talk about that God is this promise-making, promise-keeping God, no matter what it costs. That's what love looks like. And that Jesus doesn't only get that from his Heavenly Father, but he gets it from, I don't know how many times removed she is at that point, how many generations, but he gets it from Ruth. He gets it from this woman who shouldn't have been a hero in any story, but she's this amazing hero in our story who came from a strange place and maybe we were tempted to think didn't belong. But she does belong, and she helps us remember that we belong. And Jesus is this one who comes to us in our deepest moments and doesn't try to explain it away or even explain it all to us. Jesus joins us and believes that is how you help somebody survive the darkest moments of their lives. You come to them and you say, I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. I promise. And you keep your promise. So that's one way to think about preaching through the overarching story of Ruth. I think there's many other ways that we could think about that story and talk about it. But I find that stories like this, that we kind of think we know pretty well, but we actually haven't listened to carefully in a while, they can change the course of the story of our own lives. And I think that's one of the things that we need to be doing in our preaching and our teaching for people, is help them think through, how could this become something that I'm not just reading, but something that I'm living? Thank you for coming, and enjoy the